Welcome back to Past Gas. This week, we're talking about the venerable Lada Niva. I can't believe we haven't talked about this car yet. It is one of the best off-roaders, one of the cheapest cars you can buy in the world. It's still true to its like 50-year-old design nowadays. They're still making basically the same car. You've seen the memes, you've heard the jokes. Now let's get into the story of the Lada Niva. There's an island off the coast of Antarctica called King George Island. Temperatures here can drop to negative 65 Fahrenheit, and winds can whip up to 124 miles per hour. These frigid, unforgiving conditions are a number of research bases owned by countries like Chile, Brazil, US, South Korea, and Russia. You'll find ATVs, all-terrain carriers, and tracked vehicles here to get from base to base. But at the Russian base, in addition to these vehicles designed to tackle a frozen desert, you'll also find a few Lada Nivas. Call it a meme, call it a metaphor, call it what you want, but there's a reason why they chose the Niva to drive in the most brutal conditions. Because it will. How did the most basic car ever become so legendary? Why has it become such a joke? And how did a car come to be in a communist country? This and more on today's episode of Past Gas, the Lada Niva. Welcome back to Past Gas. Today we have Bart Bidlingmeyer.
Hi, welcome back to Past Gas.
Dude, don't take my line.
I'm Bart.
Oh my God.
I'm Bart.
And we got the human Labubu, Steph Gutierrez. Mm-hmm. She just explained why these little Labubu figurines are so popular right now.
It's a small, mischievous-looking but kind-hearted plush toy character designed by Kasing Lung. And part of his The Monsters series.
Wow, did you just look that up?
I just know this stuff. I got my finger on the pulse of the youth nowadays.
Are you a pediatrician or are you a creepster?
Where are you pulsing these youths?
Welcome, Steph.
Yo, what up?
Nolan is out today doing his Nolan stuff. But
what is he doing out of curiosity?
I don't want to say on camera.
Okay, well, just tell me. we can edit it. We're going to go up to this point. We can even bleep it.
For anyone who doesn't know about the Lada Niva, I know of it through like YouTube and memes and stuff. It's a very popular, very basic Russian car that's really capable and I guess kind of easy to fix. It comes with like a 21-piece set of tools in case you're in Siberia,
that's
your car
so
breaks
lit.
Down. Yeah. But Steph, you don't know what a Lada Niva is,
I
right?
I don't.
You just looked it up for the first time?
Yes, I did.
What are your first thoughts just upon seeing it?
This might be a really girl thing to say, but it looks kind of cute.
It is cute.
They are cute.
It's like a first gen like VW Golf kind of.
Yeah, it kind of looks like a cross between like a Bronco and a VW Golf.
Yeah, that's exactly kind of what it is. The Soviet government designed it to be a really cheap vehicle to build and fix. It's like super bare bones, but it's also super capable. It's like really raised up. I think it's got like a more than 10-inch clearance on the bottom.
Oh,
for such a tiny car. Really short wheelbase. And they tested it against other like Land Rovers and G-Wagons. And it just kind of like hung with those cars, which is insane because those are like
that is
probably 10 times more expensive.
This thing kind of looks sick. I like it.
Are you trying to get one?
Are you trying to sell me one? Why?
Nah. Just a disclaimer up top. We are not glorifying the Russian state as it is right now. I don't agree.
Or
with
even as
the
it
invasion.
Was. This was a Soviet era car.
So. This is just this car is such a big deal and has been in the USSR and Russia for so long that like we can't not talk about it. But in that discussion, we are not glorifying the invasion of Ukraine at all. I'm on Ukraine's side. I don't know about you guys.
Word up.
Same. Cool. We're just talking about a car. With all that out of the way, let's get into the story of the Lada Niva. Post-World War II America was an industrial powerhouse. The U.S. alone accounted for 35% of the world's industrial output. Much of that output was automobiles. Almost all of the cars were made by the Big Five: GM, Ford, Chrysler, AMC, and Studebaker Packard. There was a plethora of different styles and platforms with many different trim and engine options on top of that. There was a car for every 2.7 people in the US at the time. But in the USSR, things were different. The USSR focused on public transportation.
Actually,
we're car people here, not bus guys.
Actually, owning a car there was rare. The amount of personally owned vehicles was nearly 100 times less than the US, at one car for every 238 people.
Oh my God. Whoa.
You had to.
So you got
to
pack
mark
it in.
Your day out. I'm going to the grocery store, I'm doing my laundry. As far as options went, it was even more bleak. Aside from a few cars like the Moscovich, a small commuter car, or the Volga, which was primarily reserved for government officials, ooh, there weren't many to choose from. The Volga is named after the river, which is the longest river in Europe.
Wow.
You're a riverhead? You like rivers?
Can't say that I am, but can't say that I'm not either. I'll appreciate a good river or two.
Have you ever canoed down the LA River?
I've never canoed.
Whoa.
But like growing up, my family was really broke. So for like fun in the summer, we'd like find like a creek or a river somewhere in the mountains and like go swim around in it.
That's fun.
Have you ever done the Bridge to Nowhere hike in Azusa?
No. I was thinking there are other bridges to nowhere.
Yeah.
I haven't done that one.
So long story short, we did this hike to this bridge that is in the middle of nowhere because landslides kind of just cut it off. And it had just rained a couple nights before. And so like the whole creek, it was like a pretty shallow creek, but it was going really fast and it was milky from all like the silt.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You're turning me on.
We disregarded all these signs that were like, if it's milky, don't go in it. It's very strong. Whatever. Not like milk. But we get to the top where there's all these wading pools and like kind of 4 to 5 foot falls over rocks and stuff. And we're just like hanging out, like
wading
in like 8 inch of water. And suddenly like I hear Emily go like, oh shit. And she got sucked over.
Wow.
And then everyone thought she was joking at first.
This is the first Emily before you met the one you're dating.
Like cloned her.
Yeah.
And then she started screaming and we're like, oh, this is serious.
Oh my God.
And then I noticed that there was like a 10-foot drop on the next one. And it's all rocks in these pools too. Like she very well could have like smacked her head or whatever. She's screaming, just like couldn't grab anything. About to go over this 10-foot fall. Actually, she had gone over two at that point. And it was about to go over the last one.
And what were you doing at that?
I was trying to get out, but also not get sucked over.
Yeah.
And so I like got out. I was trying to like, I grabbed Justin's dog's leash and hopped down these rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And she at that point was about to get sucked over and like positioned her body so that she straddled this big rock.
Wow.
That was like the big rock right before the falls and was just stuck there and like trying to keep her head above water. And it was like terrifying. And so I had to like brace myself, throw her the dog leash, and like reel her back.
Yeah, I didn't know that there were that.
It was eight inches of water,
and that's
it just
because
sucked.
It
had
just rained, and it just goes so fast.
Yeah, but it was really crazy. Sorry to diverge into that.
No, that's cool.
Glad Emily's okay.
Yeah,
because that's really f-ing scary.
It's super scary. And then we found out like a month later that she was pregnant. So,
from the pools.
Yeah.
Oh my
the
God.
Milky pool.
Wow. Yeah.
Like everything else in the communist state, the automobile industry was choked by bureaucracy as car production was controlled by different administrations that changed regularly. During World War II, it was the People's Commissariat for Medium Machine Building. Then responsibility was passed to the Ministry of the Automobile and Tractor Industry, and later onto the Ministry of Machine Building. By 1957, most of these administrations were dissolved. But in 1964, the USSR reinstated the Ministry of Automobile Industry to turn some of their industrial focus back to automaking. In the middle of the Cold War, competition and paranoia were at an all-time high between the US and the USSR. From armaments to technology to space exploration, the Soviets and the Americans were going blow by blow, trying to one-up each other. The Soviets saw the massive level of car production happening in the U.S. compared to what they were making and realized how behind they were. Additionally, they saw the rising need for personal transit, for commuting, as well as tourism, and decided that something needed to be done.
In 1966, the Soviet government collaborated with the Italian car manufacturer Fiat and established the state-owned Volga Automobile Factory, or Autovaz, which would later become Lada. The location for the new factory was the city of Stavropol on the banks of the Volga River. To honor the
like how you said river with a Russian accent. Let me do it again. No, leave it.
To honor the long-serving secretary of the Italian Communist Party, Palmiro Togliatti, who was credited for being the most instrumental person in the automobile venture between Russia and Fiat, the city was renamed Togliatti. It's pretty on the nose. The new city of Togliatti was dubbed Russia's Motor City, or Russia's Motown, in reference to Detroit, the capital of the American auto industry.
So funny.
Russia's Motown. Huh?
I can't imagine any Russian being like, Russia Motown.
Russia Motown.
Wait, that was Italian. Sorry.
Here's a, you do another one?
I was like,
yeah. For Fiat, the Vaz plant was seen as a source to put new automation systems through trials before introducing them in their own factories. A 1973 article in the Chicago Tribune described the Vaz plant as ultra modern. The new high-tech factory helped the Soviet Union auto industry tackle its primary goal in producing popular economy cars to answer demands for personal transportation.
I like that there's just a dude from Chicago. It's like tearing his plant in Soviet.
The Chicago
jumping over the Iron Curtain to go check out this new plant.
And it's ultra modern.
Well, if he's coming from, but if he's coming from Detroit and he's like, this is really modern, you know, that's some, that's saying something.
It's do you think in the '70s Detroit was really modern?
The idea, I think, in America was like, oh, we're on the cutting edge of everything.
Yeah.
And so if you're coming from Chicago to the Soviet Union being like, actually, these guys, this plant is ultra modern.
Yeah. It's all Italian machinery, though. So
the first cars produced by the Vaz factory were designated as Ziguli after the Ziguli Mountains located near the plant. It was conceived as a people's car, like the VW Beetle or the Citroën.
C-twin?
Citroën.
That sounds like a Harley model.
I'm just going to say it 8 times, and we're going to use the best one. The first of the Zhigulis, the Vaz 2101, rolled off the factory line in April 1970. It was nicknamed Kopeka after the smallest Soviet coin. That's cute.
That is cute.
The Kopeka was a compact four-door sedan equipped with a 1200cc engine that produced 50 horsepower and could power the car to a top speed of 87 miles per hour.
All right.
Which would take you only about 20 seconds.
For such a small engine, not that bad.
No, it isn't.
No, it's really good.
And if you've ever driven one of those old European cars, it's like, yep, this is my life now.
Yeah. You couldn't take this on like the 110.
No. Hell no.
The car was essentially a slightly modified Fiat 124, which was already considered outdated in the rest of Europe. However, it was deemed appropriate for the average Soviet lifestyle, with modifications.
It ran on vodka. Do you guys have that? Because I know everyone has like a certain type of liquor where they're like, I'm never going to touch that.
Oh, yeah.
I think for me, it was vodka. I got over it eventually because I love to drink. Let me tell you what. But a lot of people, it's gin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's gin is like one of those herbal, floral smells that permeates
it's very
your whole,
strong. Yeah. Mine, it, I like just because it was just a rough night. Mine's isopropyl.
Damn.
I cannot drink that anymore.
That's really crazy. That's really funny that you say that because in Mexico, I mean, it's kind of like in small pueblos, like there's typically like a local drunk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if that motherfucker can't get his hands on like beer, they have 100% cane sugar. Alcohol.
Oh, God.
And fools will just down that shit.
Oh, man. That would sting so bad. That's crazy. Everclear? That's like one step beyond Everclear.
I had a buddy who got drunk on 151. We were pledging fraternity.
Did you get in?
Yes.
Nice.
Because of that.
Yeah.
No. It's because I'm a likable guy.
Oh.
But one night... You know, we used to call them lineups or whatever, but essentially you're learning some history of the fraternity, and then they may quiz you or whatever. Yeah. And they're like, Andy, what? And he like steps forward. He's like, forgive me. I know not what it is that I have done. Should I say it? It is not me. It is the 151. And everybody's like, he just made a fucking haiku. Like, it was, and he was just, anyway. So, and then he passed out.
Oh my God. I like the reaction is the haiku, not anything else. No.
Go lay down, Andy.
Okay.
All right. Back to the modifications.
Yes.
A total of 800 modifications were made to make it suitable for the unforgiving conditions of the Russian landscape. The Fiat engine was eschewed in favor of an overhead cam four-cylinder developed by NAMI, a Soviet state-run motor institute. That's N-A-M-I. I don't know what it stands for. Because USSR is actually CCCP, so... Yeah. Who knows what we're doing with this alphabet soup?
I think it stands for Blyatsuka.
Thank you, Joe.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
A starting handle was installed for cranking the engine manually in case the battery froze up, which wasn't uncommon in harsh Siberian winters. The body panels on the VAZ-2102 were upgraded to heavy steel, and aluminum brake drums were installed on the rear compared to the disc brakes that the Fiats had. Other components, like suspension, were improved for reliability and smoothness on bumpy roads.
I've heard that, like, even though drum brakes are inferior to disc brakes as far as stopping power, they're way better for... places like this because
in maintenance
the actual braking part of it is like sheltered from the elements.
And if you're if it's cold, you don't need to worry about it. Like, one of the drawbacks of it is that it overheats.
Yeah,
if it's that cold out, you don't need to worry about
I mean, truly, drum brakes were made for conditions like this and cars like this because
in its first year, 1970, about 22,000 VAZ-2102s were built, kicking off a new era of Russian motoring. Kind of. Although the cars were popular, it wasn't like the average Soviet citizen could walk into a dealership and buy one on the spot. For one, despite being a people's car, they were very expensive compared to the average salary at the time. In 1975, a Kopeka cost 5,620 rubles. That's about 16,000 in today's US dollars, which sounds cheap now, but it was more than twice the average yearly salary of someone in the Soviet Union at the time. That means a family would have to save up for a long time before they could buy one. But even that wasn't simple.
That sucks.
Yep. The government handled car buying the same way they handled everything else, with an endless bureaucracy. If you wanted to buy a car, you had to go to the local trade union committee and present your case.
This sounds like hell.
Yeah, what the... The
I love that it's like, please, I need a car.
Yeah.
Why do you need it for? What, huh?
To drive around.
Please, for God.
Please,
your business.
For God. I am walking...
$8,000 a year, please.
Look at my shoes. I need a...
I expected you to have, like, the toe shoes for some reason.
All right, where were we?
People are always like, California, I'd hate to live in California because you got to deal with all that car stuff. It's like, this is this literal is hell
exactly right.
For car people.
That sucks.
That's exactly right. The committee would do an extensive background check to see if you've ever done anything to disparage the Soviet Union. If you're approved, you'd then be put on a wait list. Might be a few months, or it could be several years.
Oh my God.
Then, once your number came up, you needed to have the cash in hand, or else you'd have to start all over again.
God.
But with very few other choices, Soviet citizens packed the waitlist to get the chance to own a Kopeka.
It's kind of like buying a Labubu, if you think about it.
Yeah, there you go.
There's that one dude waiting at the vending machine.
I just, can you imagine being like, oh boy, I'd really like the new Taurus. You know, and then it's like 3 years later and you're like, there's so many new cars.
Yeah.
I mean, there weren't that many new cars then, but just 3 years to get a car.
Yeah. Dude, Taurus is a good animal.
I don't even like, have you ever gotten like a custom plate from the DMV?
No.
Well, when you
Nolan got one, and then they were like, he got thick boy with, and it was and two
you
C's.
You have to explain what the plate means.
Yeah.
I don't even like doing that, bro. You think I can handle
it? That's the reason you're not getting a custom plate. It's my business.
It is my business. If I want to make a stupid little joke, like Nolan wants to say thick boy and not be questioned about it. You think he wants to have to explain himself?
Yeah. I'm not telling you why I want Le Boo Boo Queen on my plate.
You should get that. You should apply right now.
Right now.
Yeah. Shut
it's
up.
It's not buddy. Hard.
No, it takes two minutes. No,
but so Nolan got thick boy. It was like, isn't this great? And we're like, you have to put that on your car. And he was like, no, I don't. I'm going to hang it up. It's like, no, Nolan, that's your license plate now.
Yeah.
He's like, is it? Yeah. And then he looked it up. And he's like, I think I'm going to send it back.
That is so funny. Did he ever get like a little fake custom made plate? Now that's a thick boy.
That's easy enough to print out.
I was going to say, we should get him that.
In Mexico, you'll go down and people have California plates that just say California, like the black and the yellow, that are just souvenir license plates. And for whatever reason, it's just Wild West down there. You drive whatever license plate you want.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Mexico's very corrupt.
You're going to get dinged if you go down. You're going to be like, I heard your podcast. It wasn't just the Soviets that were clamoring for a Copeika. The economy car actually did very well in foreign markets. Despite producing only 22,000 the first year, production grew so much that the 1 millionth car rolled off the line in December of 1973. Capacity reached 660,000 per year.
Wow.
VAZ cars became so popular for how cheap they were in the UK, Japan, Australia, Finland, Holland, Belgium, and the USSR's ally, Cuba.
I could see a bunch of crazy Finnish dudes driving these and just like souping them up, driving rally with them.
Yeah, that'd be kind of actually seeing that would be so hard.
VAZ was barred from releasing the model in Italy until 1974 when the Fiat debuted a new model, the 131 Mirafiori.
Mirafiori.
The 131, the 131 Mirafiori.
Oh, nice.
Wow.
With the success the VAZ 2101 was seen in foreign markets, the original name Jiguli had to be changed because it was too hard to pronounce for non-Russian speakers.
I think you nailed it, though, Joe. Yeah.
Jiguli.
I think both of you have been killing it lately with these.
Also, the Jiguli closely resembled the word gigolo or gigolo in English, which is male prostitute. Shout out Rob Schneider.
I like how you said gigolo.
Well, that's how it's spelled. Z-H-I-G-O-L-O. Gigolo. Gigolo. I don't know.
So making gigolo sound fancy now.
The name now considered inappropriate had to be changed. VAZ and the Ministry of Automotive Industry leadership thought there was no better way to pick a new name than to hold a competition. The Soviet automotive magazine Za Rulyom, at the wheel in English, a publication that had been around since 1928, hosted the competition, and 1,800 entries were received. In September 1971, the new name was chosen from the submission. Lada, Russian for harmony, became the official brand for all export models. And in 1973, it became the overall brand designation. Regardless of the growing success of Lada, the car was lambasted for being cheap and unreliable. This negative opinion inspired many jokes at the car's expense. And we shall read some of them right now. What's the difference between a Lada and a golf ball? You can drive a golf ball 200 yards.
Oh my God.
That's good.
It's good.
What do you call a Lada driver with a speeding ticket? A liar. What do you call a Lada on top of a hill? A miracle. What do you call several Ladas on top of the hill? A scrap heap.
that's
A man goes into a car shop and asks, can I have a hubcap for my Lada? The shop clerk responds, okay, sounds like a fair trade.
These are great.
Damn. Those are really good dad jokes.
Who is going really hard roasting the Lada like that?
Dads. Dads all across Europe.
But despite that negativity that mostly came from the West, Lada's popularity kept growing. Due to the scarcity of auto repair shops in the Soviet Union, Ladas were originally designed to be easily maintained by their owners.
Imagine being a car shop in the Soviet Union. What a horrible business model. What were you thinking? There's no cars.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course there were no cars.
Sometimes I drive, like, certain streets you drive, mm-hmm. and you realize just how many auto shops there are.
Oh, yeah.
There's
just right out here.
Lot. So many.
Like,
the other thing that I think is sometimes is crazy here in LA, too. Like, you'll not just have, like, maybe a mile stretch of car shops.
Yeah.
Even along that mile stretch, there's different garages next to each other that, like, are all being rented by independent auto shops. It's like, there's so much.
Yeah. You don't realize until you see all that, like, how ingrained cars are. There was a picture. It was, like, a painting I saw a while ago that was, like, a representation of how much cars take away from
space.
Pedestrians or something. Yeah. And it was just like a street, but it was like a big canyon, you know, instead of a street. And then like all the people are just kind of like on this thin sidewalk.
Oh, I see.
But I was like, yeah, like we have dedicated a lot of our earth to cars and driving and fixing them. And like, yeah. It's crazy. But I guess in the past, like it would have just been horse stables and stuff like that.
Yeah. Vets.
Vets.
Veterinarians.
Yeah, a bunch of like,
yeah.
Like hay shops.
Mm-hmm.
Different troughs for your horse to
horse troughs.
Get a little drink at.
That's what I'm gonna start. The moment somebody starts complaining about like not enough pedestrian space because of cars, I'm going to bring that argument up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good thing we don't have horses.
Horse shit everywhere.
They run you right off the road.
Honestly, the horse shit would be bad.
Yeah. The horse shit would be horrible. The smell would be insane.
Due to the scarcity of auto repair shops in the Soviet Union, Ladas were originally designed to be easily maintained by their owners. This aspect was seen as a strength within the export markets and for automobile customers in Europe, Canada, South America, and New Zealand, as Lada was an affordable alternative to local brands. In the global automotive world, Lada gained a positive reputation as a solid, unpretentious, and reliable car under a budget. In October 74, a third production line was added, increasing daily output to 2,230 cars, which is 750,000 cars per year. That's crazy.
Good for them.
That's crazy. I'm losing my breath. That same year, Vaz produced their 1.5 millionth car. And to further assist in dropping the wait time for customers, AutoVaz acquired welding robots from Japanese firms.
Shout out to the welding robots.
Yeah. The real
took our jobs.
I'm just kidding. Yeah, they're taking it. I don't know. Listen, it's a perfect world every time, but I mean, realistically, you don't gotta be a genius to operate that.
Oh,
and that's
boy.
The part that sucks. Yeah. Oh, what, you do need to be a genius?
No, I it's your opinion.
I don't know,
you
man.
Need to be I would say you need to be an artist.
Okay, this is so stupid, but for RMS, we went to a little factory somewhere out here. I forgot. I sang Fung.
Okay. They had
like
welding robots?
Yeah, they had welding robots. And they're freaking cool. They're cool to look at. But this little dude that looks like he's no bigger than 15 shows up and the main guy's like, oh, this is our technician. And he's like, hey. And he goes, beep, beep, beep. And then it just goes down a line, perfect weld. And I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah. I've never welded anything.
I can't say I can weld.
I think Nolan...
He's learning with the...
He's learning, right?
Nolan's welds are pretty solid. I mean, structurally, they hold weight and they're sturdy.
Yeah. What's the key to a good weld?
I don't know how to weld.
Probably the heat and the gas and the eyes and putting the mask down.
I think a big issue...
You gotta put the mask down, that's for sure.
I think a big issue besides like just the practice of laying down the dimes, it's... knowing what metal you're working with, knowing what amperage your machine is at, and like the heat, the output, and all that.
The booming success of the Lada line of automobiles gave the Soviet Union even more confidence in being a competitor against the US. And now with the global demand for Lada, the company could develop for the very first time a car entirely of their own design. Shed those Fiat plans. In 1971, Vaz was tasked by the then premier of the Soviet Union, Alexei Kosygin, along with the Ministry of Automotive Industry, with building cars suitable for the unforgiving rural areas, basically most of the USSR. Specifically, they were looking for a civilized all-terrain vehicle for farmers and villagers that could be easily repaired on the fly. But Vaz wasn't the only company that was approached. Their competitors over at AZLK were given the same assignment. So AZLK made the Moskovich.
Mm-hmm.
This was all the motivation Vaz needed to create as many prototypes as it took to beat out AZLK. The result would turn out to be one of the most iconic Soviet cars of all time.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
The first prototype, designated the E-2121, came to fruition in 1971. Looking like the ugly child of a VW thing and a Land Cruiser 40 series, it was nicknamed Krokodil and was turned down for being too utilitarian. Oh yeah, pretty cool. Pretty cool. I mean, that's not so bad.
That's not so bad.
It is an apt description. It looks better than you would think. But
I think the soft top is not working for its favor. I like the wheels actually look really sick.
Yeah. Designers went back to the drawing board, and by 1974, another version was ready for the prototype stage. The 2E-2121, penned by Valery Pavlovich, is very similar to the production Niva's design. But there was a problem. The Lada 1600, Vaz 2106, nicknamed Shestoyorka, nice. The sixth
wow.
In English,
you nailed that.
Became Vaz's primary focus. So the all-but-ready prototype was sidelined, and a new one put into development. So here's where we are. They made three prototypes,
yeah.
And then we're like, no, we're going to do it again.
Well, they were like, this one's really good. Let's work right. with this one. And then
to make
it was too close to a car that had already started production. So they were like, no, scrap that, start over.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So engineers used this downtime to test the new prototype, which featured the first unibody construction of an off-road vehicle. The mule was tested alongside Land Rovers and Range Rovers in very harsh conditions for years on end. About as long as it would take you to wait to get one.
Yeah, honestly, like 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
They took also, it to the G-Wagons, too, were mm-hmm. put up against.
Okay. They took it to the unforgiving Ural Mountains, where the 2121 climbed slopes with up to a 58% grade.
That's crazy.
Dang.
It was taken to the deserts of the Kazakh SSR. The prototype endured extreme wet and muddy conditions, bounded over 3.2 feet of snow, and even forded 24 inches of water in endless torture tests. I mean,
yeah.
I could drive through 3.2 feet of snow. I mean, that's not very far to drive. I don't know. Sorry. Powered by a 1.6-liter four-cylinder engine that made 75 horsepower, routed through a four-speed manual gearbox. Weirdly, this transmission was developed in conjunction with Porsche. In 1975, the USSR's automotive industry minister, Viktor Polyakov, approached Porsche, who was financially struggling at the time, with a proposal. Porsche agreed and sent engineers to Toyota to consult on a model that was in development, the 2103. That sedan never made it to production, but Porsche engineers did have a hand in what became the Niva, including bolstering the transmission and modifying the engine to be able to run on almost any liquid.
Oh, vodka.
Urine.
I bet it was vodka.
You're in trouble.
Piss jugs. Finally, I got a use for all my piss jugs.
The car wasn't fast by any means, but it didn't need to be. It needed to be cheap, tough, and easy to work on. And it succeeded in all of those areas. Several features made it super capable in harsh conditions, including its short wheelbase, full-time four-wheel drive system with low gears and a center-locking diff, low weight, about 2,500 pounds, and small dimensions. Plus, the larger wheels that came standard created more clearance, over 10 inches. Oh, so it was less likely to get stuck.
Also, if you're coming at it from like an off-roading perspective, mm-hmm. the approach angle, it's basically like snub nose with the wheels right at the front. So like it's
you're not going to hit
unlimited approach angle.
Yes. The proportions made for unique profile, one described by the designers as a Renault 5 on a Land Rover chassis. may have looked goofy, but it did the job, and that was the designer's main goal. Finally, a prototype from Vaz was deemed worthy of approval by the Ministry of Automotive Industry. This version was considered to be a much better design and offer better performance than its AZLK competition, the Moskvich 416. Therefore, it was approved for production in the March of 1976.
Finally!
Yay! Yeah, hell yeah, dude. How many models did we go through just to get to this
one? At least three or
about
four.
Eight.
Oh, yeah. It felt like eight.
The name for the new vehicle, Neva, which means crop field in Russian.
Nice.
The name came about as an acronym for the initials of the chief designer's children. The first production Neva rolled off the factory line on April 5, 1977 in Toliati. This compact off-road two-door car immediately punched above its weight. The rigorous testing in all conditions led the designers to add two more locking differentials to make three total, independent coil suspension on the front, and a five-link live rear axle. The car came equipped with skinny yet knobby tires, a spare tire, and if you want to get it from Tire Rack, it'd be 175/80 with a 16-inch rim.
I mean, that is a super skinny tire. Yeah. With 80 is the sidewall.
That's the ratio, like that. Yeah. A spare tire that sat in the engine bay and 21-piece toolkit should the driver become stranded at any point. Although it could only reach a maximum of 80 miles per hour in the best condition, the engine could be incredibly efficient, achieving up to 35 miles a gallon.
Damn.
However, most of the time it drained gas.
Jesus Christ.
If you ever see the spare tire in the engine bay,
it's
such
huge.
A bizarre, like, it's like, why are we putting? Yeah.
Yeah. Also, if you were to drive it for any extended period of time, that rubber would just degrade right away. But if you look at the trunk, there's no space at all for.
The car was innovative, but not considered elegant whatsoever. It didn't have creature comforts that came standard on other European cars at the time, like power steering, power windows, or air conditioning. It's the old Armstrong power steering.
I'm right there with them, buddy. No power steering in my CRV.
It was likened to the scratchy wool coats worn by most Neva drivers in the Soviet Union during the brutal winters. If there was ever a symbol of the average Soviet attitude at the time, stoic, stubborn, resilient, the Neva was that symbol.
AutoVaz debuted the Neva to the world at the 1978 Paris Motor Show and started exporting later that year. Models built for export were superior to the domestic models, made with thickened metal, a reinforced transmission, and a better battery. The only other cars that could compare at the time were the Mercedes G-Wagon and the Land Rover 3, which were marketed to an entirely different crowd. Even though the Land Rover turned into a luxury car, it started out as a farmer's car, and then like people who didn't need it started buying it, and then it went more upmarket.
If you think about some of the people in Europe who owned these larger, started to be that crossover. Landowner.
Yes.
Now I would like to have some better stuff in this utilitarian.
It's
truck.
Like cosplaying as like wearing like rich kids wearing Carhartt, basically. Priced well below the competition, the Neva thrived. Soon, 80% of cars being built in Toyota were designated for foreign markets. The rest of Europe was caught off guard. Lada was undercutting Mercedes and Land Rover in a sector they had been dominating and providing a product worthy of praise. It wasn't until 1980 that a familiar name mustered up a direct competitor to the Neva. That year, Fiat released the Giorgetto Giugiaro designed Panda. And this, if you look at the Panda, it looks exactly like the Neva. Built on the same tenets of cheap to produce, utilitarian, and easy to fix, the Panda ended up becoming a cult classic in its own right. The release of the Panda made Vaz realize they had to step their game up. The standard 4-speed transmission was replaced by a 5-speed, which, the more that I read into this, the 5-speed wasn't as good. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people that bought it...
For the purposes people would buy it.
Yeah, it just was, broke more.
Right, right.
But a lot of people who bought it with the 5-speed ended up replacing it with the 4-speed. They added features like headlight wipers, rear seat belts, and a radio.
Wow, luxurious.
It was Sirius XM though, so
it's the 80s,
way,
dude.
Way ahead
it's
of their
hilarious
time.
That this is mid to late 80s, right? Where
yeah.
you're adding a radio. Okay.
Compared to the Panda, the Neva's fuel consumption was dismal, so oftentimes customers would swap out other manufacturers' diesel engines into their Nevas. Eventually, Lada caught on and started offering a diesel option. The rugged little car even found its way into some of the most iconic rally races and actually did pretty good. A French team modified a Neva in 1981 and competed in the Paris-Dakar rally, finishing third. But I looked it up. There's only like
four. Three races.
Yeah.
Four
teams.
That's how they pick their races.
Yeah. It's like that snowboarder that made it into the Olympics just by going to every competition, and she just did airs
yeah.
on the half pipe.
Just enough to qualify?
That's kind of lit.
She just did. Yeah.
Shout out to the people that hacked the system.
The next year, they came in second, beating out both their Mercedes and Land Rover teams in a poetically triumphant moment.
And those were the only competitors.
Yeah, honestly. Racing legend Jackie Ix even drove a Neva with a PRV V6 in 1987. Later on, Porsche would team up with Lada to develop a different model, the Samara, for off-road racing. The Lada Samara T3 featured a 3.6-liter Porsche flat-six and the all-wheel drive system from the 959, which is crazy to think like
yeah.
one of the most expensive supercars in the 80s gave its all-wheel drive to the cheapest car. Jackie Ix drove this car to a seventh place finish in the 1990 running of Dakar. The first gen Neva had an incredible production run from 1977 to 1993, even outlasting the USSR as a republic. In that time, the car became legendary for its ubiquity and character, but also how bare bones it was and how it reflected the late stage communist state. Now, with the Iron Curtain parted, it was time for Lada to bring the Neva into a new world. Just kidding. It basically just stayed the same.
Jeez.
In 1994, the original engine was replaced by a slightly bigger and more reliable 1.7-liter four-cylinder, now making 82 horsepower.
Whoa.
The Weber carburetor was replaced by fuel injection made by GM. Upgrades included optional AC, anti-lock brakes, airbags, new seats, a modernized dash, and a body refresh.
Wow.
Lada and GM further solidified their relationship in 1998 with the release of the updated Chevrolet Neva, aka the Neva 2. Although mechanically very similar, it featured an updated body, less reminiscent of the Soviet bloc and more akin to 90s American tastes. The name Neva was dropped in foreign markets and rebranded as the Lada 4x4 in 2006, and later, domestically in 2014, in anticipation of a new model, the Chevrolet Neva. At a time when safety innovations in cars were hitting a new high, Lada was stuck in the past. A scathing report in 2017, conducted by Russian Automobile Safety Commission RCAP, awarded the Lada 4x4 zero stars out of a possible four. It's like Star Search. And RCAP awards the Lada zero stars for a total of zero stars. In the crash test conducted by RCAP, the dummy was hit so hard by the glove box that if it were a real human, they'd have traumatic brain damage. I was hoping it'd say, like, crush this. Like,
cut the head off.
Dead. Yeah.
Well, why is the glove box popping
out? I know. And this is 2017.
That's nice. Yeah,
this isn't, we were just talking about their cars in the 80s and 90s. Now,
do better, boys.
Yeah.
When interviewed, the testers revealed they didn't have high hopes for the car, but were surprised at how bad it did. They said, quote, "It'd be naive to believe that a 30-year-old design complies with modern requirements for passive safety." In 2019, Lada was able to buy out GM's stake in the company, and the new Lada Neva was released in 2020. Despite its horrible safety rating, the Neva continued to sell well domestically. Oh, I gotta love those Russians. As of 2024, the Lada Neva Legend is available at the starting cost of $13,000 for the base trim. Yeah.
What?
It still looks extremely similar to the original, but if you want a more modern look, you can opt for the more expensive travel version, which starts at around $23,000.
From the beginning, the Lada Neva has proved to be a formidable little guy. just like a boo-boo over here.
I'm a little guy.
Yeah, and you're formidable. You're resilient.
Thank you. Yeah. I like to think so.
With tales of them starting up in temperatures as low as negative 50 degrees, as well as being submerged in bogs and back on the road within several hours.
That's lit.
That's nuts.
That's really
yeah,
good.
But yeah, but if you know anything about bogs, they preserve.
Yeah, I've seen a couple bodies in my day.
Yeah. Jeez.
Russia's Bellinghausen Research Station on King George Island off the coast of Antarctica, one of the coldest places on Earth with no real roads, has a fleet of unmodified Lada Nevas that see regular use. Although up for debate, many consider it to be the first vehicle to drive to the North Pole in 1998. In 1999, three Lada Nevas drove to an altitude of 18,786 feet to the base camp on Mount Everest, giving Neva the record for the highest vehicle attained altitude, held until 2005. So,
see, where were all those dads that were talking shit? Of, what do you call
a
Lada
on the top?
Yeah.
A record holder, baby.
Oh, nice. That should have been a billboard in front of Mercedes. Yeah. The Soviet auto industry never reached the production levels of its biggest competitor, the U.S. Despite coming up short on a global scale, the Lada Neva is still a major point of pride for Russia and Soviet craftsmanship, or lack of it. And isn't that the whole point? They were able to produce a scrappy, rugged people's car that basically went unchanged for almost 50 years. Sure, it'll break down from time to time, but at least you'll have a 21-piece toolkit to fix it wherever it breaks down, whether that's in the Sahara, Mount Everest, or Antarctica.
That is dope. Listen, what a f***ing story of trial and tribulation.
It's crazy that they're still making vehicles from what? As a company.
If you go to their site, the 2025 Lada Neva looks exactly like the 77 one, but like,
yeah, but just newer, like newer body lines and all that. Mm-hmm.
You can actually, like, there's a configurator if you want to do that.
Oh, I'm gonna build my own Lada Neva right now. Let me see this.
Well, that was the story of the Lada Neva. Really surprising story, and it makes me appreciate it more now. It's not just a meme, it's like actually a good people's car for wherever it's sold.
Yeah, for what it does, dude, what this car lacks in creature comforts, it makes up for in just ultimate ruggedness and the capability to be started in the freaking winter, you know, be able to drive through 3 feet of snow and you know, go through water and
3.2 feet of snow.
Get drowned in a bog and shit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this car is resilient as hell. And I mean, I like it. I commend it.
I think even if you don't appreciate this car, one thing to take away from this story is that if you're off-roading, you don't need a ton of power. Like 75 horsepower is enough to like go
let
up
him know,
a 58%
Joe.
Grade.
Let him know.
You don't need a huge, you know, crazy diesel truck with like 24 inches of lift to get over stuff.
We also keep talking about you can't make that car here.
No.
Right. And we've what happens to entry level cars? It's because we've got all of the safety, we've got all the power windows, we've got all the AC and the dash and the rear camera and all that crap. And here, this is what we've been asking for and can't get it here.
Yeah.
Let's see. Let's put up a Lada Neva up against my all wheel drive CRV.
We should do that. Yeah. That's the face off that people have been asking for.
I don't.
If you want us to do that, let us know in the comments. Follow my little boo-boo. Sorry.
My little boo-boo wizard.
I'm gonna stop saying that. Follow radical underscore Steph on Instagram. Follow BidZabardo on Instagram. Follow me, Joji Weber, and click and like and whatever. I don't give a shit. Do what you want to do. Do what makes you happy. If you like this, tell a friend, and we'll see you next week.